So I'm going to begin tonight with some radical statements. Buddhism is not a system of self-improvement. And relatedly, meditation is not an exercise of self-improvement. Now, of course, these are paradoxical statements, especially the second one, because, of course, we know, in fact, it's even been verified with research, that there are all kinds of benefits if one meditates long-term. This has been verified in both psychological research as well as neurobiological research. And so meditation has incredible benefits. So what do I mean by saying it's not a self-improvement exercise? Is there's something subtle here. I would say when people aim for self-improvement, what conventionally happens is someone looks at their life and they say, you know, this part of my life is going well, this part of my life is going well. Here I'm struggling. I don't like that. I need to do something to fix that part of my life where I'm struggling. And often it's a very head-centered, head-directed kind of thing. You know, often people make plans and agendas and strategies about how they're going to improve themselves. You know, and every once in a while, these plans actually work. Every once in a while, someone does make a plan and something does change for the better in their life. But that's more the exception than the rule. You know, a lot of times these plans, they kind of follow the fate of New Year's resolutions. You know, the stereotypical fate that people start out very excited and then by February they're completely forgotten. And we live in a very head-centered culture. And I think part of the neurosis of this time is the head's presumption that it should understand everything. It should have all the answers, you know. And the head is a wonderful tool for everyday problem solving. Any of the larger questions in life, the head is not very helpful. In fact, the head more often gets in the way. And especially about questions of meaning and questions about our growth, the head is not helpful at all. And I'll say also that this tendencies toward self-improvement, toward, you know, I'm uncomfortable with this life, I need this part of my life, I need to improve it. There's a lot about our society that supports that kind of way of thinking. First of all, I think there are a lot of people who walk around in society wearing, you know, it's a pattern very much driven by shame, but they walk around with kind of a mask of perfection, you know. They're the people who walk around, you know, I have it all together, you know, I have a great career, my love life is great, you know, I'm physically fit, I'm spiritually advanced, you know, my farts smell like roses, you know, all this stuff. And of course, when they're walking around saying that message, any of us who, you know, all of us have our struggles, we look at that and say, oh, maybe I'm in bad shape, they're not struggling and I'm struggling, you know, that sort of thing. And I think even among authentic people, there's a funny dynamic that plays out because all of us are so different and all of us are such unique, idiosyncratic combinations of strength and weakness, you know? And so I might be very successful in area A and area B, but in area C, I struggle. And then somebody else, maybe a friend of mine, struggles in area A, but in areas B and C, they're really strong. And then each one of us is looking at the other one, looking at their success where we're struggling and we're thinking, oh, they have it, but you know, they're more successful than I am. Like they're more well adjusted than I am, that sort of thing. And there's all these mind games that the mind plays about comparing and all that. So all that is part of what I would call the self-improvement mindset. And the mindset of Buddhism is in some sense the polar opposite. And interestingly enough, the mindset of Buddhism is deeply aligned with the mindset of healing. In fact, I think I would make another radical statement that I think any religion, rightly understood, is aligned with the logic of healing. You know, that's not necessarily apparent from some of the more loud, neurotic, conventional displays of the religions. You know, for example, in Christianity, I might say the Christianity that's aligned with healing is the Christianity of Saint Bernard, of John of the Cross, of Francis of Assisi, as opposed to, you know, televangelists or something like that. The logic of Buddhism, the mindset of Buddhism, of course, is about accepting the moment as it is, saying a complete yes to the present moment. And Buddhism is all about being honest and authentic with how we are as humans. To be human is to be in this combination of tremendous strengths, tremendous weakness, places where we're highly competent, places where we struggle, places where we're well put together, places where we're a mess, you know, places where we go out in the world and we have one success after another, and places where we just make a complete disaster of it every time, you know, and that's part of what it is to be human. And Buddhism is about just saying yes to all of that. It really is very much the logic of Buddhism to cultivate not only a deep acceptance, but even a deep allowing, just allowing myself to be as I am. Allowing my struggles to be as they are. Allowing myself to be the success that I am, allowing myself to be the failure that I am, you know, all of that. And there's a funny thing about accepting and allowing, that when we accept and when we allow, that's often where change and transformation happen. You know, that's all, and you could say in a way that's where quote unquote improvement happens. But the funny thing is that, how can I say, there's that wonderful phrase about driving in Boston, can't get there from here. You know, it's very much like that. As long as I have the agenda of at any level, that magic is not going to happen. It's only when I have completely let go of the agenda and I truly am completely accepting and open in the moment, that's when magic happens. And I'll say from my own experience, healing is so funny. It's always a surprise, and it's always different how healing plays out, you know? I mean, there are times that I've sat with places of pain, places of resistance. I sit with them for, you know, sometimes for days, just, you know, allowing and accepting. Sometimes there's a dramatic shift, and all of a sudden I feel more energy in my body, and I go out in the world, and I feel like there's more possibilities. Sometimes it's after sitting with that resistance for days, all of a sudden it just feels like it kind of vanishes. It you know, evaporates, and it's not there anymore, you know. Sometimes there's some kind of breakthrough after sitting with it for a few days, and a little space opens up, and then the next area of resistance immediately presents itself, the thing that I couldn't even get to because it was up behind resistance area number one. You know, it's like after Beowulf kills Grendel, he has to deal with Grendel's mother, you know, that kind of thing. Um, And the funny thing, of course, also is that whenever I'm going through any process, any deep process around healing, often in the middle of it, I'm saying things like, I don't know what's going on with me right now, or there are things moving and I don't understand them. And it's usually only at the end of that that the head has any idea what happened. Like, usually that's the last step of it, that the head is even has a clue about what's gone on. And so this quality of accepting and allowing, of just letting everything be, letting myself be as I am, it creates magic when dealing with our own dragons, with our own woundedness, our own inner otherness, you might say. And it also has tremendous power in interpersonal relationships, you know, and it can be the hardest thing to do sometimes, you know, with a friend, with a lover, when we're in that tension, when we're in that, you know, in the heat of it. But really extending acceptance and allowing, in a way, it's an invitation to the other person for the best parts of them to step forward. And I think we've all had experiences when we just, when we're with somebody, a great soul of some sort, who just radiates acceptance and allowing, it's just a tremendous gift to be in that presence. And it really calls forth something noble from us. And so it's always a worthwhile reflection, you know, how do I behave in the world so that I evoke nobility from people around me, you know? So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. Shared it on Zoom. So from Mr. Confucius, who says, our greatest glory is not in never failing, but in rising every time we fall. Mr. Confucius was all over the fact that, you know, the game of perfection is a silly game, you know. A wonderful, humble one from Robert Frost. In three words, I can sum up everything I've learned about life. It goes on. Beautiful one. It's actually a line, it's a section from a beautiful poem by Antonio Machado. Last night as I was sleeping, I dreamt, marvelous error, that I had a beehive here inside my heart, and the golden bees were making white combs and sweet honey for my old failures. So beautiful. A famous one from Rilke. Be patient to all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms or like books that are now written in a very foreign language. Do not seek the answers now, which cannot be given to you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answers. Kurosawaki, the great Zen master, said, in the soldier's handbook, it says that in war you must be prepared for 1,000 different possibilities. That doesn't just go for war. There's no rule book for life either. When you try to live your life according to a manual, you're sure to fail. From Anton Saint-Exupéry, the author of The Little Prince, a single event can awaken within us a stranger totally unknown to us. To be alive is to be slowly born. Shunryo Suzuki said, when we do not expect anything, we can be ourselves. This is our way to live fully in each moment of time. Anna East Nin said, life is a process of becoming, a combination of states we have to go through. Where people fail is that they wish to elect a state and remain in it. This is a kind of death. The Jungian Marion Woodman said, the more you work with your dreams and your unconscious and honor it, the more you understand it and it understands you. When you develop a relationship with your psyche this way, you begin to carry that energy into your life and relationships. Pema Chodron said, if you can live with the sadness of human life, what Choyang Trungpa often called the tender heart or the genuine heart of sadness, if you can be willing to feel fully and acknowledge continually your own sadness and the sadness of life, but at the same time not be drowned in it, because you also remember the vision and power of the Great Eastern Sun. Great Eastern Sun was Choyang Trungpa's term for the radiant power of Buddhism. You experience balance and completeness, joining heaven and earth, joining vision and practicality. We talk about men and women joining heaven and earth, but really they are already joined. There isn't any separation between samsara and nirvana, between the sadness and pain of samsara and the vision and power of the Great Eastern Sun. One can hold them both in one's heart, which is actually the purpose of practice. Bernie Glassman says, what good is it if we just make ourselves holy? What's the point? The point is to serve, to offer, to be the offering. Sharon Salzberg said, the secret to deepening concentration is the ability to let go over and over again. No judgment, no harsh condemnation, no feeling of failure, letting go of distractions gently, over and over, and returning to the chosen object of attention. This is how we make progress. Tara Brock says, quite simply, there is something wonderfully bold and liberating about saying yes to our entire imperfect and messy life. Mm-hmm. Brian Stevenson said, I guess I've always known but never fully considered that being broken is what makes us human. We all have our reasons. Sometimes we're fractured by the choices we make. Sometimes we're shattered by things we would have never chosen. But our brokenness is also the source of our common humanity, the basis for our shared source for comfort, meaning, and healing. Our shared vulnerability and imperfection nourishes and sustains our capacity for compassion. Danny Shapiro says, it is in the thousands of days of trying, failing, sitting, thinking, resisting, dreaming, raveling, unraveling, that we are at our most engaged, alert, and alive. And it is true that there's this way that the places where we struggle, we act there, some of our gold is there. We really are most alive in some of those places. Mark Jacobs said, I always find beauty in things that are odd and imperfect. They are much more interesting. Brené Brown said simply, authenticity is the daily practice of letting go who we think we're supposed to be and embracing who we are. Danielle Kupke said, despite what you may believe, you can disappoint people and still be good enough. You can make mistakes and still be capable and talented. You can let people down and still be worthwhile and deserving of love. Everyone has disappointed someone they care about. Everyone messes up, lets people down, and makes mistakes. Not because we're inadequate or fundamentally inept, but because we're imperfect and fundamentally human. Expecting anything different is setting yourself up for failure. Sobhunpun Somay says, failure is built into grace. You cannot have one without the other. It's like two sides of a single coin. Everyone who has achieved a state of grace is certain at some point to fail and to have fallen many times before. Every successful person, everyone you respect, will tell you that they have mountains of failure behind them. And finally, Michael Cooley says, may I accept other beings exactly as they are in this moment. May I accept this moment exactly as it is. And may I accept myself exactly as I am in this moment. Mm-hmm.